This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed by watching some of their work with which we were not previously familiar. My name is Matt Brown.
I'm Matthew Price. That was a remarkable introduction.
Thank you. It occurred to me we're now deep enough into the show that I have to actually probably give the premise of the show at the beginning every time, just in case somebody new has actually joined us.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Yeah.
You've probably, have they heard some theme music yet?
Yeah, by now you would have heard the...
You've heard some theme music.
The terrifying funereal music.
Now you've heard the concept of the show.
Yep.
Stick us on fast forward and go listen to something else.
Yeah. wait. Before you go, please leave a review in the iTunes store or the Play Store. We would really appreciate
Especially in the Play Store. Is anyone in there?
I have no idea.
I don't understand.
I wouldn't know how to access it if I wanted to.
No. What is it? Stitcher Radio? I don't know how any of this works.
You and I mean, to take
Spotify,
a
Spotify, are we on Spotify?
We're not.
A thing we can do?
I think so.
All right. I just don't understand why that's a necessary thing. But
I don't either. I mean, the ironic thing is that you and I essentially, for this town anyway, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, invented podcasting. But the medium and the technology have gone so far beyond us in the last 13 or 14 years that it's just like, well,
I mean, that's right. That's right, kids. 14 years ago, we invented.
We know.
You think it's new?
You'd think that we would have somehow licensed this.
In another 4 years, Kim Kardashian West will discover podcasting.
Fascinating. all right. So today we're going to look at the life and career of one of the most important and influential screenwriters of all time. That would be Shinobu Hashimoto, who didn't just write Rashomon, Seven Samurai, Ikiru, and The Hidden Fortress, but is therefore responsible by their remakes and permeation into Western pop culture for some of the most important films of all time, including one that, you know, means a little something to me. It's called Star Wars. We can talk about the actual connections between The Hidden Fortress and Star Wars later. They're somewhat overblown in popular media, but it's there a little bit.
But so is a bunch of other stuff.
Indeed. Before we get into his career, however, it is time for... Roll call.
Oh, well, let's go right into it.
Roll call.
Do it.
Roll call. This is my little corner of the show where we talk about who else has passed
away. Hold on. You are in the whole show.
I am in the whole show, but this is like the thing that I don't understand. I don't know. Anyway, I decided.
After this, I just pot you out.
Yeah. Why is Price all the way over on the far, far left?
The horrible thing is that there was one episode where I did that accidentally. Like after, I think actually it was before Roll Call, I accidentally had your level all the way down. And Jamie Dew writes in and he's like, you know, you can't hear Price for the first 6 minutes of the show. It's like, oops.
Yeah, because if you hadn't been caught.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, we don't. My QA process is slapdash.
Sure.
Yeah.
As, you know, that's as befitting me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Roll call.
Let's do roll call. So roll call, of course, is where, you know, as we do these shows only once a month, in between quite a few people do pass away, and we want to make sure that we note whoever we note. Doesn't mean this is by no means a complete list. It is a list of all the folks that died that I thought, you know, had something interesting about them that I felt like was worth mentioning. So the month actually kicked off, like literally, I think, a day or two after we recorded our previous show. The focus of today's show is passed away, Shinobu Hashimoto. So obviously more on that later. But he was like I don't think I've ever had a month where the very first person that passed away, we both went, well, that's the show.
There's the show.
Time. Right. Yep. There was no like, let's wait and see who else. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then Jonathan Gold.
Yep.
Food writer, the only food critic ever to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Food critic for LA Weekly, I believe. And I was unfamiliar with him, except that he is one of the people in the David Chang show on Netflix, Ugly Delicious. He's one of the guys that he hangs out with. So I knew I had seen him a little bit in action talking about LA food trucks and taco trucks, that kind of stuff.
Cool.
And a really interesting guy. You know, you say food writer, it's sort of this reductive thing, but actually I think there's probably a lot to check out there.
Mm-hmm.
Adrian Cronauer. The main character and subject of Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh, right.
Yes. Radio DJ who was, and this is my favorite fun fact, was replaced when he was fired for making fun of Nixon. He was replaced by Pat Sajak.
Neat.
Yeah. So Adrian Cronauer passed away Sergio Marchionne, who was the CEO of Fiat Chrysler, and brought, I think, probably the last great auto tycoon, because he actually brought Chrysler back from the brink and brought Fiat back from the brink.
Fix it again, Tony.
Yeah, there you go. Fix it again, Tony. The joke about Fiat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, he passed away, and like quite young. I think he was only like in his mid 50s, maybe.
Hmm.
Oksana Shachko, who was the founder of Femen.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. She was only 31. She died. She suicide.
Hmm.
Elbert Howard, one of the founders of the Black Panthers.
Okay.
Passed away. Bill, now, so this is interesting. Bill Loud. Do you know who the Loud family are?
I do not. I know some Loud families.
You do. We all do.
Yep.
We all do. Bill Loud was the patriarch of the Loud family, which was the subject of the arguably the first reality television show, The American Family.
Hmm. I haven't even heard of the show.
It was a show on PBS in the 70s where they said, we're going to take cameras and follow a family for a year and live with them and see what happens to them. And then he had an affair, and they like got a divorce in the middle of the show. It's incredible what happened to them. And eventually was the inspiration for one of the first mockumentaries, which is the Albert Brooks movie Real Life, basically takes its premise from The American Family.
Oh.
And it was a true sort of cultural sensation, this show, when it was on the air. Charlotte Ray. From The Facts of Life, and Different Strokes, Mrs.
I don't.
God, I sound like an idiot now. I know everyone is screaming.
Recall.
It's Mrs. So-and-so. Anyway, she was the main character on those shows. She was the maid on The Facts of Life, and then the maid on Different Strokes and the spinoff show The Facts of Life. She runs the girls' school.
What was that woman's name?
Yeah, I know. I should know. Anyway.
I wasn't enough of a fan of The Facts of Life, although I did watch it.
I mean, it was on.
I mean, that's the thing about television back then, especially the sitcoms. They were the thing that was on after
dinner. They
were
on. That's what TV, that's one of the best descriptions I've ever heard for television. Television's not supposed to be good. It's just supposed to be on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nikolai Volkov, pro wrestler.
Cool.
We actually lost a couple of pro wrestlers this past month. I mean, it's not a, I don't believe it's the kind of job that lends itself to a lot of longevity, but he was relatively senior.
Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting. Douglas Grindstaff. Douglas Grindstaff was a sound engineer, worked in television, and notably was the sound engineer for a show in the 60s called Star Trek.
Oh.
And he did all of the beeps and boops and pops and noises that you hear in the background.
No.
Of every
how
episode.
How did I not know that this
Star
first,
Trek?
How have the, I never come across this name?
He created the door whoosh. Yeah, there you go. He did all of that, like, in the back, all that stuff. Yeah, yeah. So that's
great shit.
I thought that was cool. You know, like that was like a cool thing that you could tell your kids. I did those noises, right?
Well, I mean, especially given that so many of them persist today, like they're using those sound effects on Discovery.
Well, they have to.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. It's this thing's going to last forever.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize because I don't remember his real name, but the star of a Lady Gaga video who got quite well known because he was completely tattooed over his whole body. He went by the name of Zombie Boy.
Yeah, I don't know his real name
and,
either.
He was a male model and other things, but he had tattooed himself with sort of skull motifs over his whole face. And, he wound up taking his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I guess all I want to say is that, and in no way to be glib about this at all, but I'm pretty sure you can't get that kind of tattooing work done if you're like completely happy in life. Like, I feel like at the very least somebody should have been looking out for that guy.
It's a pretty extreme body transformation, that's
for
sure.
Yeah And so, you know, I suppose if you're determined enough these things can happen, but it does kind of suck that nobody was like, hey, you should, you know, let's get you into some help.
Well, a lot of people could have been. You just, if you're not there at that moment of truth, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Joël Robuchon, who was a chef, first chef. This is kind of amazing. He got 3 Michelin stars in 3 years at his first restaurant, and over the course of his life accumulated 30 Michelin stars. Most chefs work their whole life to get a Michelin star.
Yeah.
He had 30. His death was announced by the French government. hockey legend Stan Mikita.
Don't watch hockey.
Don't watch hockey. Stan Mikita, great Chicago Blackhawks player. Certainly one of these guys that I always heard the name growing up because my dad, my grandfather all loved hockey. And also immortalized because when they couldn't use Tim Hortons in Wayne's World, they called it Stan Mikita's Donuts. Because he is a Chicago Blackhawks player,
mm-hmm.
and Wayne, quote, lives in the suburbs of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
because really it's Scarborough, but
yeah.
they, you know, for the movie, they moved it to Chicago. So instead of Tim Horton, they said it was Stan Mikita's Donuts.
Not bad.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
There's many jokes in Wayne's World that are like that. Robert Sillman, who's a building engineer, he passed away, he saved Falling Water.
The
masterpiece house by
Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank Lloyd Wright, yeah. Thank you. I always want to say Buckminster Fuller, but that's incorrect.
Lloyd Wright. I understand he did Balls.
Yeah. So Frank Lloyd Wright, who designed, and I've been to Falling Water.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've been there.
I have not. There's a lovely Lego set of it.
It is amazing. And Falling Water is not only an amazing building, but it was completely, you know, it has the water going right through it. It was going to completely fall to pieces,
mm-hmm.
and he essentially saved it. The other thing that's cool about Falling Water, of course, is that it's at this weird scale because he wanted everyone to be at like a low height so they could really appreciate all the vistas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So like the toilets are a foot off the ground and nothing makes any sense. like it's truly a house that's designed by an architect going, well, I just think you should feel this way. It's like, I gotta go to the bathroom, man.
Yep.
Richard H. Klein, who was another, so again, not a great month for directors of photography.
Mm.
Richard H. Klein, who was the director of photography for Camelot, Soylent Green, The Monkees,
mm-hmm.
created the look of the show The Monkees, Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yep.
And I think most incredibly, the Lawrence Kasdan film Body Heat, which is pretty much the greatest film noir in color.
Yo, easily.
Ever.
Yeah.
Right? And fun fact about that movie, because that is a banger. Man, that is a great movie.
Yeah.
For many reasons. But it's a movie that exists. The idea of turning it into a color film noir is to make everything feel like it's a million degrees and humid,
mm-hmm.
the whole time. They shot the film in the middle of winter. It's freezing in most of those scenes.
It's very impressive.
It looks like it's 1,000 degrees.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And then Ronnie Taylor, who was director of photography for Gandhi, Cry Freedom, The Devils, Tommy, started as a clapper boy in the 40s.
Wow.
Shot The Innocents. He was the camera operator on Star Wars. You know, yeah, it's not great.
Wow.
You know, that's a career, man.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So, yeah, he worked with Ken Russell and, you know, then went on to do, like, all this other stuff. But I guess he was just on staff at what's the studio where they start?
Did they do Pinewood for Star Wars? Or
I can't remember if it was Pinewood or the
or
other
Elstree.
One. I feel like it's Elstree.
I know it was Elstree for Empire. I just can't remember if they did Star Wars at
anyway,
Pinewood.
Anyway, I guess he was just, you know, like, available.
Yep.
It was such a massive shoot, I guess, that they, you know.
And also, that's
the studio
just,
stuff
that's
it
British
is huge.
Filmmaking, right?
Right, like, you just do
it's
whatever
a trade.
Is available.
You just
yeah,
do
yeah.
the jobs.
Yeah. V.S. Naipaul, who's the Nobel Prize winner for literature. So the other wrestler was Jim the Anvil Neidhart.
Okay.
Passed away. Former partner of Bret the Hitman Hart.
Mm-hmm.
Painter Mary Pratt, who would have, sadly, you know, that's one of those things with female painters is they're always known by who their more famous male husband painters are.
Mm-hmm.
She's married to Christopher Pratt, who is quite a well-known realist painter.
Chris Pratt, the Guardian of the Galaxy?
No, different Chris Pratt. But Mary Pratt has these absolutely gorgeous canvases. They're great. She's amazing. Check her out. I noticed that she did get her an obit in the New York Times, but it was like more than 2 weeks after she died.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows you like sometimes this shit's not cool. They would have, for him, they would have right away.
Sure.
You know.
Sometimes though, I'm not trying to defend them because you're probably right. It's just I've also noticed there's a few instances where like if someone has sort of fallen out of the limelight, the news doesn't circulate for some time. Like,
I
think we
lost
Robin Leach the other day, and he had died like several weeks ago.
He's on my list, but it took a while. And sometimes that's the family. But in this case, she was, like, it was in the papers here, and it just didn't, you know, they hadn't picked up on it. Nobody in the art critic part of the paper had sort of made mention, right?
Gotcha.
Morgana King. I love playing this game where it's like, you should know who this is. Morgana King, who was an opera singer, but was primarily known because she played Mrs. Vito Corleone.
No
shit. The Godfather, yes. Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah. So she...
Wait, the older or the younger?
No, the younger.
The younger. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. She's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's terrific. Yeah. We lost Aretha Franklin.
Oh, yes.
Of course. We don't need to... What can you... I don't... Everyone has said everything better than I could possibly say it. But that is massive.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Are we gonna?
I think we're gonna try to do Aretha Franklin for September. It's gonna obviously
we'll
be
talk more
slightly different then. Structure to the show, just because not a lot of film work. Although I have posted a list on our Letterboxd of films where she was in the soundtrack, which, by the way, almost all of them are Respect. That song gets a lot of play in soundtracks.
Yeah.
But there's also some pretty interesting movies in there. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's what's great about, first of all, about Blues Brothers, that they use Think instead of Respect.
Yep.
And also great that in The Big Chill, they use Natural Woman instead of Respect. Mm-hmm. Like, they, you know, when they do choose another piece, it's always amazing.
Indeed.
So she passed away. Kofi Annan, former Secretary General of the UN, and probably... you could arguably say saved the UN from oblivion.
Yeah.
Changed its focus to a humanitarian organization in a way that is profound.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Harris, the actress from Nashville, many other films, but primarily, notably, an original member of the Second City and the first person ever to go on a stage in a Second City review. So the very first Second City review, she was sitting on stage alone.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, but hundreds of great performances. Barbara Harris is great. And if you haven't seen Altman's Nashville, you know, don't sleep on that. It's really, you know, she's terrific. Everybody's terrific in that. Craig Zidan, who was a producer of musicals, eventually went on to produce the Oscars for many years. So he's responsible for... bringing Neil Patrick Harris into the Oscars, turning it back into Hugh Jackman, turning it back into more of a show, but also produced all of the live musicals for television over the past few years, and sort of reignited this love for musicals. And one of the producers of Hairspray. And, Ed King, guitarist primarily for Lynyrd Skynyrd, but also I found out was the guitarist from the Strawberry Alarm Clock. Which is a great name for a band. If you Strawberry Alarm Clock, their only hit, only song that I am aware of is Incense and Peppermints. So he was the guitarist there. And then, yes, we did lose Robin Leach. I'm not going to do.
No, the thing I won't do is the impression either.
Yeah.
I will say that I was astonished upon learning that he had died, to learn that he had died at the age of 76, which means that when that show was getting started, he was basically my age.
He's younger than us, yeah.
And that freaks me the fuck out.
Yeah, but also, like, so I talked about the Loud family and kind of the very first reality TV show, but I think you could arguably say that in terms of what we think of as reality TV, Robin Leach invented that.
A little bit.
Like, the idea that you could do a show where you just follow rich goofs around and see what they own.
Yeah.
And that would be a show. Like, you just, there would be no conflict.
Yeah.
It's just, let's go visit some rich goofs.
Yeah.
And see what idiot stuff they bought.
Yeah.
That they're real proud of. That's the show.
He was 20 years ahead of his time, at least.
It was massively successful. I don't think people even can understand how popular, how big a part of pop culture in the 80s that was, and how it perfectly coincided with everything else that was going on in the 80s about, you know, sort of conspicuous capitalism and all this stuff. It's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, depressing.
Yeah.
Indeed. But kind of amazing, right? So, And you said he passed away several weeks earlier and didn't. Yeah, I only found out about it.
It was only publicized in the last couple of days.
Yeah. John Carter, not the one from Mars.
Nope.
But film editor.
Yeah.
95.
Mm-hmm.
And edited late in life probably his biggest film. So it was like he became the go-to editor for, I think, younger black filmmakers mm-hmm. who were making sort of accessible fare like Barbershop. And like he did big films.
Yeah.
And this is well into his 80s. He actually started out, his sort of early partnership was with Elaine May.
Mm-hmm.
He worked on A New Leaf and he worked on, and he edited Mikey and Nikki,
yep.
which is this great sort of like Cassavetes film that Cassavetes is only in
mm-hmm.
With Peter Falk, but it's fantastic and nothing like his later work. And boy, imagine, you know, we talked about this with John Mahoney a bit, but this idea that you could start, that it's never too late. I mean, I think he edited his first film when he was like past 40.
Right.
Right. So yeah, John McCain.
Yep.
You know.
That happened.
It happened.
Yep.
Lindsay Kemp, who is Bowie's choreographer.
All right.
For all of his tours. And many
That's a big
things.
Deal.
It is. He's also, I think horror movie fans would be interested to know that he played the bartender in The Wicker Man.
Oh.
Yes. Yes. That guy. That guy. Huh. Yes. And then just like, I think yesterday, Neil Simon.
Yeah, we're recording this on the 27th? Yeah, 27th.
So
yeah,
Neil
he died
Simon,
yesterday.
It's impossible to overstate. That is, you know, it's an indelible, I would say almost Shakespeare-like change in how we understand theater and how we understand character on stage and how you can construct something that is perfectly comedic and still perfectly dramatic at the same time. And,
right.
And I don't think anybody ever did popular playwriting better in the history of the world. Like, that's that big a deal to me.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, and I don't think anybody really appreciates how much every other type of comedy that they sort of enjoy now, especially like sort of television comedy and things like The Office and whatever, how big a debt things are owed to Neil Simon to sort of make that possible.
Right.
Just this morning, it was announced, apparently, Roseanne Conner.
Huh?
Well, they're going to kill Roseanne's character on The Conners. They're going to kill her, which I think is great. She's not going to move away in case Roseanne stops being crazy. They're going to full out deadify her.
I mean, that's terrific, but they did kill Dan Conner twice.
Yeah, but he's
back.
And
he's still on that show.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then also today, Jazz, and I only bring it up because I love his name, Jazz Great Mr. Bongo. now, he has a real name,
but
he was known as Mr. Bongo, mm-hmm. and he was 95. And, and I just love that there was that Jazz is one of these things where it's like, yeah, he's Mr. Bongo. What?
Fantastic.
Yeah. So
fantastic.
So that's roll call.
Right on, man.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Shinobu Hashimoto, another writer who arguably permanently changed the way writing was done for his particular medium. In this case, it'd be film. So
yep.
I'll do a little bio.
Please.
First of all, he is our very first centenarian, born on the 18th of April, 1918, in Hyogo Prefecture in Japan.
So he was 100 years old.
He was 100 years old when he died.
Wow.
He enrolled in the Japanese military in 1938, just before the war started, but he came down with tuberculosis and spent several years in a sanatorium as a result, obviously going out of his skull board. So he, based on having been lent a film magazine by a friend, kind of got the idea that he would write a screenplay about his experiences there. Once he was done the screenplay, he asked, I don't know who, but someone, he was like, who is Japan's greatest living screenwriter? And was told it was Mansuku Itami. So
yeah.
He sent Itami his script. Itami
just
was
to see what would
just
happen.
To see what would happen.
Yeah.
Itami apparently impressed enough that he agreed to mentor Hashimoto.
That's funny.
Until his death in 1945.
That did not happen when I sent my script to Paul Thomas
that
Anderson.
Is
I didn't
never,
hear back.
Yeah, exactly. Has never happened on any script I've ever sent anyone, but terrific.
That's so amazing.
Yeah. So he gets some work produced in the 40s, and that gets him in with Kurosawa, who has this idea to do a film after The Quiet Duel. And Hashimoto's been working on an adaptation of In a Grove, the Japanese story that becomes Rashomon. And I just wanted to read this. This passage is from the Criterion obituary of Hashimoto, just because It's funny, and you'll see why. The two men didn't know one another, and Hashimoto was startled when he received word that the famous director wanted to see him. Their dueling accounts of the meeting are a bit like the discrepancies told in the story itself. They met at Kurosawa's house. Hashimoto says they talked for only a few minutes. Kurosawa said they conferred for hours. Hashimoto says that the Kurosawa script could be fixed to a proper length if he added another story, which is the framing sequence with the gate. Kurosawa says that adding the gate stuff was his idea. So even in the genesis of Rashomon, no agreement.
There's no truth.
That's right.
Wow.
Indeed.
That's amazing. They must have agreed on that.
Yeah.
Beforehand.
That's right.
Let's tell them all this. Yeah.
So Hashimoto, of course, goes on to write 8 of the screenplays for Kurosawa between 50 and 70, which is arguably the director's greatest period, obviously also the screenwriter's greatest period. He did Rashomon, Akira, Seven Samurai, Record of a Living Being, The Hidden Fortress, Throne of Blood, The Bad Sleep Well, and Dodeskiden. Now, let me just backtrack real quick to the beginning of that list. He did Akira and Seven Samurai back to back. It is crazy that Kurosawa did that. They came out within 8 months of each other.
Yeah.
Hashimoto also on both of those films. I would argue those are two of the greatest films of all time, and they came out within a year of each other. That is just
incredible.
Yeah, you
throw Rashomon in there just a year earlier.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
What's going on here?
It's an incredible run of creativity. Kurosawa favored what I think we'd now call the writer's room approach to screenwriting. He liked to work in groups of 3 and 4 to write. So it's not as though you could say that, you know, Hashimoto solely wrote any of these.
Kurosawa he's there in the room. Yeah, absolutely.
He's part of that process, and I just think that's an amazing run. Hashimoto, as you may or may not know, only directed intermittently, but in 1982 he was given carte blanche on a film called Lake of Illusions. This was greenlit sight unseen by the studio based on his success writing all of the films I had just mentioned. It turned into a 2.5-hour disaster that immediately ended his career, and he died on the 19th of July, as you said, in Tokyo at the age of 100.
Yeah.
So let's get into some of the work. Do you want to go first or should I go first?
Why don't you go first?
All right.
Just because I'm very curious about the film that you watched.
Sure.
So
we all know.
And we should preface this by saying you're the one who's in the seat that I'm usually in, meaning you had already seen, I think, virtually everything the guy ever did by reason of seeing everything that Kurosawa did.
Indeed. And, you know,
so I had more
sort of Doom and Samurai Rebellion and all
I had
of that.
More to choose from.
So I made an earnest effort to track down a copy of Lake of Illusions.
You did. You asked people on the internet.
That's right. I went into not the dark net, but let's call it the gray net.
Sure.
And still couldn't find a copy that had subtitles. I was able to find a Japanese copy, just I couldn't get a copy with subtitles. So that remains on my bucket list. I hear it's terrible. So
I feel
I
should have watched it without subtitles.
Yeah, you know.
Just to be like, whatever.
That's a good point. But, you know, obviously one of the things that is a hallmark of the Kurosawa films of this period, and a lot of them were the ones that Hashimoto was involved in, is that Americans jumped on them and remade them as Westerns. And we know about A Fistful of Dollars, and we know about The Magnificent Seven. What we don't know about is that there was an American remake of Rashomon called The Outrage.
Oh, is that? I did know that, but is that what you watched?
That is what I watched.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I didn't even know this thing existed until I started doing the work for
this
show.
It's not great.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I give it a lot of credit for. So it was directed by sorry, I've got his name here somewhere. Martin Ritt.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Which totally tracks.
Yeah, he had just done HUD with Paul Newman.
Yeah.
And so here.
It's an earnest attempt. It's not a
no.
It's not a cheap ass 50s Western. This is like a classy 60s.
It is a classy 60s Western. This is 1964. And Ritt certainly there is no illusion made about what he is trying to do. He very specifically quotes Rashomon visually repeatedly throughout the film.
Sure.
He's going for a very similar mood.
Right.
Probably from our standpoint, the most extravagant mistake would be casting his HUD star, Paul Newman, as the Mexican rapist.
Yeah.
And, you know, desperado
boy,
character.
Boy, that kind of thing doesn't age well.
Oh,
it's a shame because
boy.
Everybody's trying their best. But
I know. Everyone is trying their
best.
And
not the first time, I think, or maybe not the last time that Paul Newman tried to play, you know, ethnic.
Yeah.
Which is never great.
And he is, you know, he is literally in brownface. It is, again, I get it. It's the time. People simply had not wised up. I mean, white culture had not wised up to the inappropriate aspects.
Well, and
of
nobody's
doing this
making
work.
A movie with a Mexican in it. Come
no,
on.
No, of course not. Why would you do that?
You know, unless
that would
Speedy
be
Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Like that.
Exactly. But I mean, I do admire what Ritt does here. Like I said, he borrows heavily from the original, but he clearly also knows how to construct a scene on his own. The stuff that takes place in the, well, I mean, the original story is called In a Grove, so I was just going to say the titular Grove, which is where the varying versions of the assault take place.
Grove full of tits.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. It's obviously a soundstage. He does a lot of great work with it. The fight scenes between the bandit and the nobleman.
There's really no attempt to try to change it much. It sounds like it's just
what blew my mind
onto different ethnicities.
Right? What blew my mind is they actually do the victim's account, which in the Japanese story is done through a medium, and here is done through an old Indian man who communes with the dead in front of the town,
so
the court.
Same thing.
Like I really thought if they were going to leave any beat out, that would be the one. But no, they basically cover the entire original script of Rashomon, and it's okay. It's creaky. I certainly didn't enjoy watching it. I thought, you know, for the most part, the performances were pretty good. And even within the cloak of his performance as a Mexican rapist, Paul Newman, well, I guess we, you know what?
I don't think it's possible for Paul Newman to be outright bad. I just think he's probably miscast. But
no,
like,
he is.
There's, you know, if there was a better natural actor, just like a guy who, like, you just always believe him.
Well, exactly.
Talks, right?
So he does do an admirable job between the three versions of the story of providing some, shading to the character that allows you to conceive of conceive of how he sees himself, which is important to the first story,
right,
and then also conceive of how he is seen by the society that has, you know, penalized him and so on and so forth. So, you know, yeah, and I mean, best thing about the whole movie, and I got a huge holy shit from me, the movie does take place, it does have the same framing narrative as Rashomon, which it takes place in a train station, in this case during a torrential rainstorm,
right,
where three characters meet, including a young priest character standing in from the monk from Rashomon, played by, in 1964, 30-year-old William Shatner.
Yeah.
And played very earnestly.
Yep.
And Edward G. Robinson is also there, one of the other characters there. So just
that's great. There old is and a, new Hollywood.
Yeah,
that's
there
great.
Is a hoot happening in those scenes.
People forget, like, the, you know, he wasn't Captain Kirk yet.
Yeah.
He's just a guy trying to get work.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, and the movie looks terrific. It was shot by James Wong Howe.
Cool. So it
really lovely photography.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So that's the, you know, that's a noble failure. That's the Cinderella Man of
a little bit.
You know, like they're trying their absolute best. They're throwing all the tech stuff at. They really want to make a quote unquote, you know, important movie.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, these things are hard to pin down.
Yeah. And, they, you know, so again, like, maximum credit to them for taking it seriously. I do think it is funny that in all of my travels and all of my studies, I'd never heard that Rashomon was remade, obviously hugely overshadowed by Magnificent Seven and Fistful of Dollars. And then the other thing, which I will just say my canned spiel, which is that God bless everyone who thinks that The Hidden Fortress is that Star Wars is a remake of The Hidden Fortress. It is not.
No, not even close.
Not even close.
It sort of has a Han Solo character.
A little bit.
And it kind of has an R2 and C3.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like what Lucas directly takes from The Hidden Fortress is the idea of structuring the story around its two most inconsequential characters.
Right, right.
And that is definitely, you know, clear to see and very charming and in the original as much as in the remake.
Yeah.
But that's about, and yeah, there's a princess that they need to move across enemy lines. I get it. But that's about as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I watched Harry Carey.
Yeah.
Which, by the way,
I had also never watched.
Oh,
so
wow.
I watched as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a couple things that just to say. So this was made late. I think it was after he sort of, I guess, I don't know if he parted ways, but he started working apart from Kurosawa for a while and then came back for Dodeskoden, right?
Yeah.
Like they stopped working together when Kurosawa went off to make Yojimbo and Sanjuro, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And then he does Redbeard, and then there's a little period of not working as much, and then, they reunite.
And so I don't know whether that was just because he had those ideas for those stories really clear and didn't need the collaborators, or he just, or what, but I mean, they're very, I think those films stand out. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Redbeard yet, but definitely Sanjuro and Yojimbo seem different.
Mm-hmm.
They feel a little more outlandish than other Kurosawa films in a great way, but they feel more like entertainments.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
He's really trying to make things that are just fun.
Yes.
At that point.
Those two films, absolutely. I also think that Kurosawa becomes more didactic as he goes along. So Redbeard is, I think, quite a good film and very handsome, but is also very on... His films become more and more on the nose as he goes.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a...
So I don't know what the situation was, but they do sort of split up.
Mm-hmm.
And for his part, you know, he continues to write pretty much in the same vein that he has been writing with Kurosawa. Like, if you look at Sword of Doom and you look at this film, you know, they're samurai pictures. And, you know, you say, oh, they were turned into Westerns. They are Westerns, these samurai films. And I think they, you know, and it's just, it may be coincidental that both countries have this period of sort of, not lawlessness, but self-law. Like law of just whoever happens to have the power in that region.
Yep.
Because the samurai era has that, and so does the Western era in the U.S. There's no like overarching government or anything. It's just whoever happens to be in charge in locally is making up the rules, and that has benefits in terms of being able to structure stories that are about morality and individual choices, because they share that sort of similar. Like milieu around them.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
So I'm not going to say that one is copying the other. I think it's just more like that set of historical consequences, of historical sort of setting and social rules and whatever. It's so ripe for writing stories where individuals and their individual actions matter.
Yeah.
And so you're always drawn to it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, there's probably a similar sort of thing to be said for stories set in the Middle Ages in the UK. And like there's various times in history when this becomes the way things happen, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that idea does draw kind of the major difference between the Western and the Japanese, which is that the samurai are a nobility class in Japan, just as the knights served the nobility class of England.
Right.
Whereas theoretically, this is very American, in the Old West, if you had a gun,
there is no class.
You could be a hero. Yeah.
Well, and also there is no class.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of America, is to throw off class, right? So by its very existence, it's going to reject that. But but you can also argue that the gunfighter character is a nobleman in the sense that they're often coming to the aid of the weaker.
Yeah, well, they operate by a code.
They do it by a code, but anyway.
So
I think, you know, he continues to make these films, and I think you could fairly say that this movie absolutely feels like a Western. It's a very much a movie about power and corruption and overcoming a sort of a wealthy but corrupt land baron, for lack of a better word. It's very similar to a lot of Western.
Yeah, like and like
right?
many of Hashimoto's own scripts, there's a lot of very good commentary here about class and about the pressure of economic disparity.
Yeah.
You see that
recur
over and over again in his work.
Yeah. What I think is really what struck me watching this and thinking about Rashomon is how much both stories are structured as, well, I'm going to tell you a story, but then I'm going to tell you more information that changes that story, and then I'm going to tell you a new story that changes both those stories.
Right.
And even though it doesn't do it under the same idea of one moment, it has that structure where it starts, you think it's about something, you think a character is one thing, then they enlighten you with a whole story that tells you how they got where they are, that changes everything about what you thought about them. It's really quite beautifully told in that way. And it's such a, like, I don't think I've seen a movie that's such a slow burn.
I know.
Where you're like, you know, here's the thing. You know in the first 2 minutes that people gonna get fucked up with swords. This is gonna happen.
Yeah.
At some point in this movie, there's gonna be some very nasty things happening with swords. And then you spend the whole movie, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You spend 2 hours and 10 minutes building up to what has to be the greatest sword fight.
Yeah.
I think it's better than
certainly
this.
One of the best one man against 100 fights
I think I've ever seen. I don't even think that the action in Seven Samurai is sort of as incredibly crazy as some of the stuff that goes on at the end of this.
The final act is really something. One of the things I really enjoyed about it, well, not enjoyed, but I thought was really striking is that, you know, the first act is very austere. It sort of takes place largely in a courtyard. It's a lot of conversation.
Yeah.
Beautifully shot, obviously, but just, you know, very happening. And then there is actually an early death. I don't want to give away spoilers here, but there is actually an early death, and it is so gruesome.
It's grisly.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It just... Well, I mean, the movie is called Harry Carey.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Let's not to give anything away, but it involves that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
but
it
I just
is,
think as a way of building tension that he shows you this awful moment early on, and then again, like you said, he steps back.
And then you get to expect it for the rest of the movie. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's great. And the, you know, all the performances I think are great. And it's so, it's beautifully photographed, as you said. There's this, you know, the Japanese, fortress, castle. What are they living in? It's like a, you know, it's a house, but that's sort of not really.
Yeah, it's a cat. We'd call it a castle.
And just the way that he, you know, there's a moment very early on when two characters are walking down a hallway, and they're exactly spaced apart so that the hallway is basically regular breaks of open pieces and panels.
Mm-hmm.
So as you walk by, you sort of appear and disappear, and he exactly spaces the character so as one disappears behind a panel, the other one emerges from the next panel, and like they're perfectly timed. It's great.
Yeah. I think it's an extremely clever script, and that it's one of the few scripts where you really are behind the characters pretty much the whole time. It's very difficult to predict what the motivations are. There's a period of time where you think Tetsuya Nakadai is telling the truth, that he's absolutely there to kill himself. There's a period where you assume he must be playing a game with them. And then there's, you know, when it comes to a period where you realize that he's actually a man with nothing to lose, you're just like, what the fuck is going to happen now?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just, very nicely structured for that.
Yeah. It's, you see a lot of movies where someone takes their time to take revenge on a person.
Yeah.
But this is a whole other level of that. It is great.
It really is.
I'm so glad I watched it.
One of the things that I'm sure happens to you all the time and also happens to me is generally people, you know, they hear that you're into films. They assume you've seen all of them, right?
Sure.
And the truth is that, you know, none of us have. That's crazy and impossible. But second of all, you know, no matter how deep into your career of watching movies you are, there are still, thank goodness, just gems like this that you haven't had time or opportunity to pull out.
Yep.
And God, I certainly enjoyed watching The Outrage, but I watched this immediately after and I was like, oh man, that's a good movie.
Yeah.
That is a really, really good movie. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
All right. So that is Shinobu Hashimoto for this month, for August of 2018. We will be back in September. I think we are committed to doing a show about Aretha Franklin. I have never seen The Blues Brothers, so I can tell you right now, that's my movie.
I haven't seen
The Big Chill.
Yeah, that's, oh my goodness.
This is what I'm talking about. There's always more stuff. There's more things to reach for.
Do them
in
both,
drawer.
Man.
Yeah, maybe I will.
Do them both. I would not say that Aretha Franklin is the reason to watch The Big Chill, but that's okay.
But as an excuse.
Boy, that's a good movie.
But that's the thing. Like,
we just finished talking about Lawrence Kasdan and Body Heat. I mean, I think, You know, there's talk about a run. That's a run, man. 1979 to 85, Lawrence Kasdan. It's a pretty good run.
You did pretty well.
Yeah.
I as an alternate title for this show, instead of Death Watch, The Excuse would be a good one, because like that's part of the fun for me. Is like, not that I'm glad these people have passed away, but when they do, you're like, oh man, I'm gonna catch
gotta
up
go
on
appreciate.
this, and this.
Yeah.
And paid off.
So
this
other than the two films that we talked about, what should people watch by Hashimoto?
If you haven't watched the Kurosawa films, I'd say they are all worthwhile except Tedeschi Den, which I think is basically garbage.
Yeah.
Obviously, like the 1-2 punch of The Bad Sleep Well and Throne of Blood, which is Macbeth and Hamlet, sorry, not in that order, that's a very interesting way to adapt a classic story, which we don't see a lot. Like, nowadays we're so obsessed with fealty in any adaptation.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like back then it was like we can take the
swing
basic
the
aspects
fences.
Of an
yeah,
idea
yeah.
and
yeah.
then just transplant it wherever we want. And maybe Shakespeare lends itself to that, but I don't think that's actually true. I think you could do an adaptation of Lord of the Rings set in space, and if you know, it would be just as interesting or awful as your own personal creativity allows for. I do think Sword of Doom is a bummer, but is worth watching.
But it's a bummer, isn't it?
But it's a bummer. Yeah, you know, it's a bummer. What's the name of the one that happened three? Something about shellfish. I'm a sad little shellfish.
Oh, yeah. That's the one he directed, right?
He directed one of them. There's been three of them. He directed one of them.
Okay.
I didn't get a chance to track that down either, but I'd be interested in finding out what that's like. Yeah. But anyway.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back at the end of September. And as always, you can follow us on Letterboxd at DeathWatchPod. We're also on Twitter at DeathWatchPod, hosted at ModernSuperior.com. If you want to go throw some money in their coffers on Patreon, we always appreciate it. Bye.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.